The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 48 of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique.
So this is episode 48. We're coming out in March 2022. And our guest on this episode is Richard Beard, who's the author of 11 books, a blend of fiction and some nonfiction. I think we spoke to Richard at the end of last year. I think it was December. Yeah, it's all quite hazy now.
A very, very long time ago. who knows, by the time you're listening to this, you might be in a nuclear bunker somewhere. But certainly, yeah, the end of last year, we were all preoccupied with very different things.
Out of the COVID frying pan and into the nuclear fire. So we better get on with it. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Beard. It's quite a typical question we ask at the moment, but I think a good one to begin with is whether you have any such thing as a typical writing day and what your day today, for example, has looked like if you do.
I don't have a typical writing day, and I'm definitely not a, got to write every day type of person. I'm a binger, is that I have quite a lot of time just thinking and not doing very much. But then when I get going, I will sit down and I will write all the hours that God sends. So no, I don't have a strict routine. This morning, today, I'm doing something for a newspaper. So that does require a bit more discipline. And I will just sit here until it gets done, basically. Not very good at rationing these things out. So if there's something to be done or I've got my teeth into something, I just get on with it. But it really doesn't bother me. And I think it can be quite intimidating to people who feel that they have to write every day and you have to do a certain number of words every day. And I think it can get in the way sometimes. Nothing as good as thinking. Well, writing.
Do you find there's a point where you switch from the sort of thinking to the writing? Is there something that all the thinking crystallizes around, or some switch that changes and you think, okay, today is going to be the day? Or do you have a sense that you're building towards in 3 weeks' time that day's coming? I can kind of feel it's close. Or does it hit you by surprise and you've put down 2,000 words and...
Well, I think it's just a combination of all those things, is that, you know, it tends to be that it will coincide with, you know, when you have a bit of time available, luckily, that's when you need to do it. Also, like a thing which Keith Ridgway told me once, which is that he does a lot of kind of pre-writing where he's trying to kid himself he's not actually writing. So you do a note here and a diary entry there and a bit on the back of an envelope here. So you've started, but you haven't told yourself you've started. And I think that can be really useful as well. So then when you do actually start, you've got all these different things you can refer to. So you use yourself as a source of all these kind of secret treasures that you've put, you know, you buried beneath trees somewhere. And you're just going to sort of pick them up and take them out, and that helps you get going. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. There's not a clear demarcation between thinking, and then there's a big bugle sounds, you know, on a day which I've decided on in advance. But I like having all these things squirreled away, and I suddenly get them out. I think, oh, there's some quite good stuff here. I can do something with this, and then I will start in on it.
And do you tend to contribute the stuff you've been accumulating for that project, or is that a sifting process? Because I know you do some nonfiction writing as well. Is that a kind of sifting process for everything you've been accumulating? Some of it feels like it goes into the pot. Some things maybe for later.
Yeah, I'll sort of know where these things are. You know, I don't want to waste loads of time kind of trying to look for these things, having discarded them and lost them. But I was thinking at the beginning, I want to get all this stuff in. That's the sort of main driver there. I'm saying I want to get all this in. Then in the process of writing, I'll realize, well, there's some things I just can't get in. I mean, it doesn't really fit. It's still interesting and it's good, but this isn't going to get in. And very rarely do those things get into anything ever. I mean, once they haven't got into this, they never even nearly connect to any other project. But there are those things which nearly connect to a certain idea and then don't, and they'll have to go. But I certainly start with the idea, everything here I want to get in. And some of the things which look difficult to get in, they create some of the best connections and some of the most interesting kind of creative moments when you say, I can get this in, it's a little bit sort of tricky and this is going to require some real skills and I'm going to have to do my best backflips to get this in. But actually, you're going to end up with some really good creative solutions by doing that. So I think that idea of I've got all this stuff and I'm going to try and get it all in is a good place to start. Though you have to admit that some stuff just won't work.
Do you have any sort of order to the notes and the various material that you collect before starting to write? Are you either in terms of the format that you're putting these notes down, or are they all in the same notebook, or are they scattered in post-it notes and all different forms and formats of note-taking? And do you sort of have any order or cataloging system in terms of what the notes are about, or where they fit mentally within what you're thinking about?
Well, I've realized that after 11 books, not all of them fiction, not all of them novels, but that I do it slightly differently every time. At the beginning, if you'd asked me this question after a couple of books, I'd have said, this is the way I do it. And I would have tried to suggest it was the only way to do it. And everyone else was foolish because they didn't do it my way. But in fact, I do it slightly differently every time. At the moment, I'm a big fan of big, unlined A4 notebooks with lots of pages in, and things tend to go down in there. So at the front, there are the notes from books that I'm reading, which are relevant. And in the back, there are my ideas, which have obviously they have something to do with the books, but I feel that they're just coming out of my head and they're not connected to the books. And then when I come to the stage of wanting to get writing, I'll read it all the way through from the beginning, all the way through from the back. And I'll just pick out those lines. They tend to be lines, most a paragraph, but tend to be one line, two line, three lines maybe. I'll pick out all the ones which I look at them and think, yeah, that's really interesting. And I'll start getting them onto the computer. But again, with no particular order at the beginning.
Just, this is a really personal question. Well, it's not personal in that sense, but just from me. With the bit at the back, you're starting from the very back page of the book and working towards the center in reverse. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah.
I also do this, and you're the first person I've ever spoken to who at least has stated that they do that. And I always thought it would look kind of crazy to anybody else, but I'm heartened to hear that there is someone else that does the same sort of thing, using a book the wrong way around as well as the right way around at the front. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I'm going in both directions. Maybe you are crazy if you're just going from the back. You're going from the
front. No. I mean also, yeah, going in both directions for slightly different purposes. But it's interesting that someone else has come upon this. Yeah.
It's quite pleasing, isn't it, to think that, you know, eventually you're going to join in the middle. You know, the stuff that you bring along with the stuff that other people bring, it joins in the middle and everybody's happy.
Yeah, I've never got to the middle or the point where they meet yet to see whether the back or the front goes quicker. But anyway, that's quite a niche conversation.
Yeah, I tend to have more going forwards from the front, the things that I'm reading. But those individual lines coming from the back, there's much more in there to be unpacked. So it looks less on paper, but it's actually more once you start developing it as a book.
Yeah. I guess on the format of the notebook, I realize that's just what you're working on at the moment, and you have different approaches. But using a non-lined pad, are you still writing in line? Are you writing as if there were lines there, or are you using the page differently in any way?
Yeah, I am, but I can't deal with. I have authority issues just generally, but lines on a page, I just can't deal with that. I don't want to be told where I should write my lines. So I'd much rather have an unlined page. And, you know, sometimes it's an idea which is three lines very close together, and sometimes it has a bit more space. And I think it gives room for my unconscious to say, well, give this one a bit more space because you're going to come back to this and you're going to write between the lines. And I think it just, you know, it allows ideas, you know, in a very literal way to find their own size, to find their own shape.
You're not doing sort of five columns and mind maps and arrows going from here to there then. It's fairly similar to as you would write on a lined page, but with that extra sort of room to move around the notes.
Yeah, but every time I come back to it and every time I look at it and think, yeah, that's quite interesting, there will be asterisks added to that couple of lines. There'll be more thoughts added on. And I tend to use a different pen each time so I can see what stage I came back to it. So it won't end up looking just like four lines on a page by the end. It will look like a huge annotated scribble. but I have very, very small writing, or I'm able to write very, very small letters, which means there's always more room. I think that's quite useful too.
And at that stage, how fully formed is the writing? Are you putting some sentences down that are the kind of polished prose that you're aiming for? Or is this quite sort of jotting notes and just developing ideas?
Well, so some of the ideas will arrive as sentences, which I think, you know, or phrases that I think, yeah, that's a nice phrase. That's a good phrase. And I think that's a bit like music. If someone comes up with a riff, they'll go, they don't really know where it's going to go or how they develop it, but they actually think, yeah, that's quite nice. And that it seems to me it has a closer connection to music, that. So the phrase will be that. I think that's a really nice phrase. I'm going to use that. And I nearly always do end up using that phrase. It may change. It may be honed and tweaked later on, but there's something there which just says, yeah, that looks really nice to me. You know, with all my experience as a reader and a writer, there's something nice about that. I can do something with that. And a lot of these little notes are in that kind of form. Just, you know, if you think about a musical term, it's just a couple of notes together, which you go, yeah, that's a sound that I can live with that, and I can do something with it.
And when it comes to sort of moving on to a draft, I don't know how formally you draft and how much you consider them to be separate iterations, but would you continue to write freehand for the first draft, or does the typing begin at that point?
I mean, again, that's the thing which has changed, is that the first couple of books I wrote them all out, or the first draft was always by hand. And I had a whole ritual of the kind of paper. I had to use Clairefontaine paper. I don't know if you know this paper, with squares on it. So again, going away from the lines, but it's mathematical. I like the idea. I'm going to get a bit more precise now. And they had to be double-paged, no perforations, Clairefontaine paper, very pleasing. Yeah, these little booklets of 4 pages. And then I would go through those, edit them again by hand. So it would be fountain pen, then edited on a biro, and then put onto the computer after that. So it had already gone through 2 drafts before it even got on the computer. And I think that was quite useful, especially when I was starting out. Now I think there's a bit of time wasting in that, a bit of procrastination. I get it on the computer a little bit earlier. But I mean, I never really understand how people calculate drafts. Some people sort of jump up and down and say, I've got a first draft. I would never celebrate a genuine first draft because it seems so far from what the thing might turn up, you know, what might become. And really, I'm going to be looking to go through this stuff tens and tens of times, 40, 50 times. And I don't really know where one draft becomes another. So I tend to think of drafts where I just do a major reform of what I've got. You know, so really, yeah, whole countries can change, characters can change, everything can be in a different order. That for me is a new draft. And the other bits where I'm just going through honing the sentences, and they don't really count for me. But it does mean I've been over every sentence, you know, a lot of times. And I could never count the drafts, really. I'd never be able to say, give an answer to that question, how many drafts, I don't know.
In terms of the first pass, I guess, do you work in a sort of linear way, I guess? Or do you start from where you think sentence one of chapter one is, and then work towards the end of the final chapter? Obviously that may then move and shift around when you come to reappraise it, but is that the way you tend to start and work the way through, or do you write a couple of chapters and then think, oh, this is not working, but I got an idea for something further ahead, I'm going to jump to that and start working on that and write a couple of chapters?
I think I have an idea. I plan a lot less than I used to. I used to be very proud of my plans. One of my novels, Lazarus is Dead, I invented this structure called the angel wing, which I was incredibly proud of, smug even about it, because I was so pleased with it. So you have 7 sections. It goes down to the number 1, 7 down to 1. You have a kind of countdown. Lazarus dies, and then it goes back up in sections 1 to 7, and there's a certain number of sections in each of these chapters. And what it looks like, if you put it on a piece of paper, is it looks like an angel wing with Lazarus's death in the middle. And that is the structure which then informs everything that happens in this book. It creates a kind of Olympian structure to follow. And I like that a lot. But that was the last time I did that. It was almost like I thought, I can't do better than that. That's great. And I still think it was really good. And I was saying, you can probably hear how pleased I am with it, even though it was more than 10 years ago. But I don't really do that anymore. Now I do think more in terms of linearly, how will this story work out? I've got my notebook. And I say, you know, I know numerically it's going to be between 10 and 20 chapters. That's how it sort of always kind of works out for me. So I'll just sort of write down those sections 1 to 20. Then I'll go back through the notebook. Very important that the notebook is numbered, has numbered pages. The little snippets that I've got that I want to get in, as I was saying earlier on, I'll just put them into the category of each chapter. And then when I go through, I'll write the whole thing through to the end, using up that material, taking it out of the notebook, putting it onto the computer in these very vague categories, in the knowledge that that could all change later on. But it does give a sense of direction, and it does mean I can get to, you know, what looks like, I'll know at the end, if I've got to the end and there's over 45,000 words, I've got something which looks like a book. If I've got to the end and I've only got 20,000 words, there's clearly something's gone wrong. Or if it's a lot longer than that, I don't really like, I'm not a big fan of writing long books. So I think something's gone a bit wrong here as well. So it gives you an early indication of whether your proportions are correct, which again could be one way of giving yourself confidence that you're on the right lines, I think. You know, if I've got 15 chapters and it comes to about 60,000 words in a first draft, you know, I'm in the right area, really, if I feel that there's something there.
That's interesting, the sort of mapping from the initial notes. And I guess this is going from the notebook with the two-sided, the notebook where you're writing from the start and from the end. You're mapping from that onto another notebook where you've got 20 different pages, or I guess there might be more than a page, 20 sections for the 20 chapters roughly, and you're moving the content from the first notebook into the second.
Yeah, that's going onto the computer. No, but yeah, okay, but the content isn't moving onto the, there's not a notebook, there's then a code. So on that second piece of paper, I can get that on a double A4 spread on my notebook. So I will have my page numbers from my notebook, so I will just write down, you know, 25, 29, 33, and I'll go back,
right,
and I will know, because I'll put the number beside that entry in the notebook, the number of the chapter that it's going to go in. So they kind of cross-reference to each other. So it's just a kind of, it looks like a wicked and dastardly code, but it's not really, it's not maths, it's still literature.
And is your approach to putting the material together for the nonfiction that you write kind of similar to that as well? I mean, I guess you have some things imposed on you in terms of the kind of temporal reality.
Yeah, I think in fact doing the nonfiction has informed the way that I've changed the approach to the fiction, really. And I think it's made the fiction less forced in a structural sense. I mean, when I describe that structure to you, it's clearly quite artificial. It's something which can be imposed on the creation of the book, and it helps to generate text, but it is an artificial construct. And the way I'm doing it now feels more organic. And that's come from the nonfiction, because with the nonfiction, I can know what I think the major kind of structural pylons are, and there will be interviews, there'll be specific memories, often in my case, because it's been memoirs that I've been writing, specific stories I want to tell. But it is more organic in nonfiction. For example, if I want to do an interview and I know I'm going to talk to someone, it may turn out to be absolutely brilliant and have to be the center of one section of the book. It may turn out not to amount to much, and therefore you've got to sort of think of another solution and remain much more flexible than I was with the earlier novels. And I think the kind of lack of flexibility is partly what makes them interesting, those early novels, but it's also a bit of a problem, I think. It can be constraining in a way that isn't entirely. The idea is the constraints generate interesting material, but sometimes the constraints can just feel constraining.
Do you have I'm thinking of, for example, Acts of the Assassins, obviously a book that I assume required a bit of research or something that you were very familiar with already. When you were going back in that note-taking phase, were you going and reading a lot of literature related to, you know, the, I don't know if it would be literature, early scholarship on the Bible and things with apostles, etc., or was that stuff you had already accumulated and then it was now the notes are being pulled together for the...
No, I went to find it after I'd had this kind of idea, and then the idea will form and reform as it's informed by the reading. So once I knew I wanted to write about the apostles and how they died in these utterly spectacular and fantastical ways, fabulous ways, in fact, in the sense that they're from fables mostly, these very baroque deaths of the apostles. And I started reading them, and that started informing material and gave me sort of inspiration for where the story could go. But yes, and I still have a bit of a pre-internet prejudice about this, is that I could have looked up, you know, the history of the apostles and how they died on the internet, But I have a prejudice, which is actually all the interesting stuff is not on the internet. Somehow, if I read it in a book, if I go to the British Library and I read a book from 1947 about the apostles, I am convinced that I will find interesting stuff in there if I read attentively that I will not find on the internet and that nobody else knows. And again, that gives me confidence. Is if I research off the internet, I always have this feeling in my mind, well, if I got this off the internet in half an hour, everybody else knows this stuff. You know, what? How's that interesting? I want to bring something which nobody else knows, which means going to old books and old libraries, which just by chance is something that I really like doing anyway.
Just out of interest, speaking specifically about that book, what sort of vintage are most of the tales? Because they're quite, I don't want to say lurid, but they're a very spectacular, I think, as you said earlier, deaths involved. Is that stuff that you can see people talking about in kind of 100 AD, or is that there's a big explosion in 1500 of people writing in that kind of graphic detail about it?
This is a little while ago. I would say it's pre-Renaissance. It suits the kind of medieval mind in terms of being very colourful and entertaining stories. You know, of the apostle, I'm trying to remember which one it is now. He's wrapped in papyrus. I think it's Matthew, wrapped in papyrus, which is then soaked in dolphin oil and he's set on fire. You know, this is the kind of John Wick of 1350. And hugely entertaining for them, and actually hugely entertaining for us as well. And that's part of the reason for wanting to tell these stories in the novel.
Hey, what you reading for?
This is where the benefit of reading comes into play.
Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
Can I just go back to the non-fiction side of things? It's obviously with the apostles, it's maybe less relevant, but you mentioned write a lot of memoirs in your non-fiction writing. Do you see a sort of clear divide between memoir or writing from yourself in a way and writing as fiction, obviously coming from yourself, but is there any divide there, and how do you sort of classify that in your mind?
No, I think there's a lot of crossover, and in the way that I write memoir, it sounds counterintuitive, but I'm someone who's got a terrible memory who writes memoir, and therefore I need to research my own story to remember what happened and find documents and testimony from about things that have happened to me, and that becomes very similar to researching a novel. But I also think that the skills that I learned by writing novels first have come in incredibly useful, in the sense that if I sit in a cafe and I talk to someone, I interview someone for a nonfiction book, if I were just to write that down, it wouldn't necessarily come alive. But the skills that I learned writing novels about characterization, for example, I know how to set the scene. I know how to frame the kind of incidental business around the dialogue that we have. The dialogue is real. But the gestures that I choose to put in between little bits of dialogue, those choices are informed by what I know works from fiction, setting up conversations in fiction. So I think the skills have been incredibly useful. They're very useful in terms of pacing. I think one of the challenges of nonfiction when you're writing a true story is, well, how do I pace this so it reads like a novel, as exciting, as interestingly as a novel does? And those are lessons that can be applied if you know, because I've written fiction before. Structure, you know, it can all be real, it all kind of happen, but that doesn't mean in my book I have to write it down in that order. Again, that's a liberation which comes from fiction, and which makes nonfiction much more interesting. So I think all these skills cross over from nonfiction, from fiction into nonfiction. Going in the other direction is quite interesting, because when you get that taste for things which are real, it makes my relationship with fiction a bit more difficult now, because I have to justify anything which is not real and think, well, how, you know, why is this important in the way that something which genuinely happened is real? And that's a kind of ongoing process.
I mean, I think that's there's not really an answer to that question of the balance between real and unreal. I mean, for a lot of people, I feel a lot of people don't read any fiction, and they see fiction, the entirety of fiction, as something for children perhaps, but not something that you need to read as an adult. But obviously a lot of people do get a lot of value from fiction, and finding the balance and the value is, I don't know, for me, I think it's a personal question that people have to find the value they find. And yeah, there's not an answer, but it's interesting to hear how you can sort of navigate between those two. And I wonder, like, in your writing, is there any temptation do you find when you're writing memoir, especially you say your memory is not, or you need to go back to the sort of source material sometimes to refresh your memory. Do you find a temptation to sort of veer into fiction and need to pull it back towards, well, these are the facts. This would make a good section of a novel, but actually I need to pull it back here? Or
not really, because I think that kind of counterfeiting would be very obvious. If, you know, if I find a document and it says what happens and doesn't tally with my memory, well, first of all, I'm quite happy to write that in the book. You know, I remembered it this way, and now I've got this document, quote the document, say, well, this is actually how it happened. Isn't that interesting? And that's actually a space there to think about why the mind creates memories in that way and about how I'm recreating it when I'm writing it. But to straight counterfeit something to make for a better story in a nonfiction, it's not really a temptation because I just don't feel that the question really arises when you're using source material. If I'm using these sources very clear, you have coroner's reports or newspaper reports. Now, the newspaper report may be inaccurate, but it is there as a source. And you can acknowledge the fact that it might be unreliable if I have a different version. But there's a kind of conversation starts then about what is true and what's not true. And as soon as you're in the area of memoir, the idea of truth again gets as slippery as it does in fiction. And I think that's why it's almost a natural area for a fiction writer to get involved in, because what is true, what is not, what's fictional, what's not, what's made up is as relevant in memoir as it is in fiction. And a lot of the same conversations are had with writers about this. You know, what actually happens to you? If you write a novel everyone likes, the first thing, well, unless it's about the apostles, everyone says, did this happen to you? You know, that's every writer who's written a contemporary novel will have heard that question.
This is going back also to the fact that you suggested that your memory is not perfect or not that great even. Did you find, because I know your most recent work that's been published was about attending public school. So I assume you talked to some people about your experience of being at school. Did you come across anything that was completely not necessarily the opposite of what you remembered, but very different to how you had recalled it? And did you have to kind of recalibrate your own memory as a result of speaking to other people?
This question about memory and how different people's memories change was more the subject of the memoir before, which was about the death of my brother. The one about my school days wasn't really about disputed facts. It's not an area of disputed facts. There aren't specific events which can really be disputed. It's more about what the impact of those events are and what the attitude towards those was at the time and then afterwards. Now, clearly, attitudes can be different, and they are different. I mean, other people have very different attitudes, but they don't dispute the events. And in that sense, it became more of a memoir which is verging on a polemic, because it is about attitudes as well as the memories. And the fact that people disagree, again, becomes part of, you know, your classic ingredients for a book is that you need some conflict. And there are conflicting attitudes, and the book accepts that and attempts to meet them head on. But with a kind of confidence, or if you like, the only authority I can bring to it as the writer is to say, well, this is what my attitude towards it is, and I'm prepared to argue it, and I will argue it in this way. You know, that's all anyone can do with their own life experiences, really, is to say, well, stand up for that experience and for this reaction to it, for this emotional response to it, but also try and just communicate to other people why, in that instance, why I feel the way I do about it. And if it convinces, then I've done a good job of the writing. If I haven't, well, clearly it's because the reader has prejudices which I can't overcome. Never the flaws of the writing.
Do you find any difference in the sort of tempo of work when you're taking that work when you it's more polemic, and presumably you're writing more from your gut in a sense, in that it's landscape that you're familiar with. In terms of your writing day, were you sort of just putting the words down at a rate of knots compared with writing, say, about Lazarus, where you have the angel wing structure, and were you perhaps taking more time per word with that novel because there are more questions and structural considerations, whereas with the polemic you're able to just sort of gush it all out? Or was it fairly similar and you're still deliberating even though it is polemic form.
Yeah, the nonfiction is quicker. There was a formulation, like one of these sentences I wrote down once, which has appeared in a book somewhere. I'm not quite sure which one. I just liked for the sound of it. It was as I was thinking about people saying that fiction is when you create something from nothing. And I said, well, that's not quite right. It's when you create something from everything. You know, there's loads of stuff in a novel, and you need to use everything you know. It's not something from nothing. But I think when you write nonfiction, the everything is clearly a bit more is limited to stuff that's happened to you or stuff that is true in the field that you're looking at. Therefore, you can do it more quickly. You don't have to take into account all the possible everythings that might be useful to your novel. You've just got a more limited number of everythings which will be relevant to that nonfiction project. So I think nonfiction for me is quicker. Yeah, I write it quicker. The whole process happens more quickly. But I know more quickly when it's going well. And with fiction, it can take a while sometimes before you see something quite where it's going. It's much sort of longer game of chess, really.
Quite a tangent. I'm just interested in whether you're someone who's always written. Are you one of those people who has a sort of trail of manuscripts from when you were in your teenage years? Or had you sort of fiddled around and just decided at some point that you wanted to really dig into it?
I don't have this biography of being a precocious child who at age 8 wrote a novel which is bound with pictures in and has known ever since they want to be a writer. And I've never been much of a raconteur, storyteller. I'm in conversations, I'd much rather have conversations which sort of interact with each other rather than conversations where someone stops, tells a story, which might be very entertaining, but it is a kind of solitary pursuit. So if I'm going to tell a story, I need to sort of sit down and work out how it's going to work. It doesn't come to me naturally as it does to famous people who are famously good as raconteurs, which isn't a word you hear very often these days. It sort of suggests cravats and cigarette holders at a dinner table, perhaps in an embassy. So I had to make a decision, which I pretty much did when I was at university studying literature, that I love this reading business and I would like to give writing a go. And it was a conscious decision. It wasn't something that I felt sort of vocationally marked out for by a great ray of sunlight from the heavens at an early age. It was a conscious decision. And then it became a bit of an obsession in the years that everyone has when it wasn't quite working out. It was more of a sort of dogged obsession rather than feeling I was being drawn on by the heavenly light.
I mean, with your thing about the precocious kids, just it reminded me of a thing. It might even be on the Wikipedia page, which is, as you've said, there's things in books that you can find out that aren't on the internet. But talking about Orson Welles, and so I'm pretty sure it might still be on there. It says that he learned to read at 2, maybe even taught himself to read at 2, and was putting on plays at 5. And I was just thinking, there's a lot to unpack there, isn't there? Like a 5-year-old putting on plays. I don't know.
Yeah, but when I hear that story, see, I think of this small child, either incredibly psychologically healthy and just expressing themselves from an early age, or I see a small child really needy to please and really sort of finding self-esteem in the applause of others. And I think you can read books which read as very needy objects. There are authors when they write, you feel the need. Sometimes you feel this in very popular books. There's a real need to be loved, and it creates a different texture in the text than if you have a book which develops on its own terms, develops organically, makes the most of what the form can be, and it can be much more than a 5-year-old standing on a table performing for an imaginary audience.
That idea of being seen, I think there is something different about fiction as well, in that I think when you approach fiction, you're approaching it with the question of why did somebody make this up, which is it's kind of different than a lot of, you know, if you're reading memoir nonfiction, the general assumption is that this is the truth, and you've not got that question at the forefront of your mind. Why did the author make this up? So the author kind of can be a bit foregrounded with fiction in a different way, I think, than in other forms. And then that makes the author, the process of writing, the author has to be kind of aware of that and then move things around to make it make sense for the reader why the author would make stuff up. You're always kind of looking for a clue, or I mean, maybe it's just the way I read, but I reading fiction, I'm always kind of looking for a clue of why these things have been put down on the page in this way. and you know where what it's leading to, or what associations it's trying to conjure up. And it makes the author, yeah, a kind of figure in the text that you're kind of trying to spot, even though they're never there. They're lurking somewhere just behind the text. And yeah, you could see that relation to, well, with the Orson Welles, the child needing to be seen, the author needing to be seen in fiction is, yeah, a curious kind of relation with the text, because at the same time, it's fiction has nothing to do with the author or anything to do with them. You could imagine an author of fiction should be somebody completely solitary who's not seen at all. But there is obviously an urge towards that in writing fiction.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of critical theory in what you just said.
But I guess it relates a bit to what you were saying earlier, Richard, about the idea that making something out of nothing for being fiction and making something out of everything. Like the author is, surely it's, on one hand, it is, you're writing something that's not autobiographical and you're writing something that is completely unrelated to you, but you've made all of the decisions. Like it's actually saturated in your kind of mental environment at the same time. You probably give away a lot more than you think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I don't think you can escape that. And that kind of relates to what we were just talking about, is that, and then as a reader, you can kind of join in with this kind of reading, almost like a universal therapy. You know, the more you understand about how the book's made and the psychology which makes the book, and then what's on the surface and what's behind, what's on the conscious area of the book, what comes from the subconscious, the more you'll understand about the world around you, the more you understand about other people you meet. Whereas one of the great virtues and values of fiction is what is hidden there. And I think a lot of the time the author, when I write a book, I won't really know. When I go through my notebook and I think I really like this line, I won't know why I like it, but there is some genuine reason why certain lines speak to me. Is that when I read a book, I will take my notes and say, on an average 250 page book, I might take, you know, 8 quotations out of it. Now, I don't know why those 8 lines have spoken to me and not the rest of the book. That most books, there's loads of interesting stuff, but those lines have spoken to me for a reason, which is why I always have a pencil with me when I'm reading, whatever I'm reading. If something really jumps out at me, I will take it out and I'll put it somewhere, you know, in a diary, you know, what they used to call the commonplace book, I think in the 18th century, would you say, or Jane Austen type of thing, early 19th century, the commonplace book. Does that ring a bell?
I think it's the first time I've heard this yeah. term.
So you put down these observations, but I am a great believer, is that my brain is trying to tell me it likes this line for a reason, and therefore there is stuff to unpack. But clearly, when you're writing a book yourself, you don't want to unpack everything. As first of all, your book will be very, very long. But secondly, that's part of the game that the reader likes playing as well, is to unpack some of that stuff you haven't unpacked. Poets seem to do both at the same time. They both unpack a very small idea and then sort of create more material for the reader to unpack when they read it. So they're going in both directions at once. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why poetry can be so intense. And feel like it's so condensed and got so much in it.
In poetry, the balance between sort of concise phrases, you've got a limited number of words. It's going to have to be concise. You might have four words on a page, and that's a poem. But the nebulousness of it becomes all the greater. Like there's some sort of inverse relationship almost between the amount. Obviously, if you have a 1,000-page novel, it's got a lot to unpack as well, but you're not going to have anywhere near the sort of nebulous quality that a 4-word poem has.
Yeah, and I think if I read a 1,000-page novel, I really expect the author to do quite a lot of the work for me. If I'm going to read the 1,000 pages, I want life explained, really.
I'm just reading William Gass's The Tunnel at the moment. I was trying to read a sort of big book in December, and I was listening to Michael Silverblatt's interview with him in, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And he was asking why it's so sort of challenging, the first 90 pages, and kind of alienating. And William Gass just said, oh, I think like, yeah, the reader's going to go on this journey with me. I think they really need to do some work beforehand to like get them ready for it. I was thinking that's quite the attitude to basically say, yeah, it doesn't start really until 90 pages in, but you've got to really wade through those 90 pages first.
There's a lot of confidence in that, but there is some logic in it as well, because then you can say, well, you've invested that time. you know, you're going to stick with it now. You want your dividend because you made your investment. And there's some truth in that when you're reading a difficult book, is that the rewards feel all the sweeter because of the difficulties before you start to get to them. Or maybe the difficulties create the rewards. Well, do you think it completely changes after page 90? Do you think it just becomes a rip-roaring read after that point?
I wouldn't say a rip-roaring read, but it becomes much more conventional and straight. And you can just see exactly what's going on all the time. It's not, I mean, yeah, I think it is quite distancing and alienating before that. To what, I mean, I've got about 150 pages left. I need to see to what end that would have been done.
Yeah, again, mark of an interesting book. If you're thinking, I've got to get to the end to see how that works. I mean, it means that the whole book is working together. There's an integrity there, which you know is a good sign for those last 100 odd pages that you still have.
But possibly not entirely to William Gass's credit. I almost never give up on a book. I do a lot of due diligence beforehand and then try, if at all possible, to finish it, which has led to me having to kind of absolutely hate 500 pages of a novel. That's on me. What are you said you're doing some newspaper writing at the moment. Are you working on a longer project as well in the background?
I am. I've had to put that down, in fact, while I do this. Related to everything we've been talking about is I want to look at where the crossover between memoir and fiction is, which is clearly both interesting in itself, but it seems to me to connect quite closely into the kind of experimental literature, you know, that you're talking about there, but experimental literature more generally. You're looking at kind of hybrid forms as one way in which people make experiments. And clearly, my novel's been in a more experimental tradition. I'd say that the nonfiction's been fairly traditional. And I'm just really interested in what the crossover points are in practice on a page. So I'm looking at that, but it's still fairly early days. The notebook is filling up. But I'd say, yeah, a bit more in the front than the back. But the back is, you know, the back gets filled up with those eureka moments when you wake up and you suddenly think, oh, yeah, that would go in there. And there are a few of those still happening. So I'm still at the stage where I haven't done enough to stop thinking this could be brilliant, you know, which is best place to be in the writing of a novel before you're actually writing it. And it all is out there before me.
So you're filling the notebook now. This is for the longer project. So how do you sort of envision the time frame for it next? Like, when are you close enough to a structure and things that you might start to go on to the next phase? Have you sort of set like New Year, then I'll start writing on it? Or is it just you really wait until it just feels like you've got it all brought together?
I have actually started doing a little bit of stage three, which is putting it onto the computer, which is and starting to just join up a few of these paragraphs as well. So I'm a little bit further on than that, you know, that first stage. And I'm beginning to have those first doubts as you join things up about, you know, does this really make any sense? But, you know, I'm holding on to that earlier feeling of, no, everything is possible. But I would think that once, you know, I'm really... I start that once I get to a kind of cliff edge of, you know, various concerns about there's self-loathing of not doing enough work. So you start doing work. There's all I could do with some money, which is another reason to get started. There is the fact that when I first started publishing a long time ago, when people were much more confident about publishing, they used to say the ideal way to publish was you got your hardback 1 year, paperback 12 months later, and then you should have another book ready to go the year after. So every year you have, so basically take 2 years for each book. I've never managed that really, but it's always half in my mind that, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Very unlikely to happen, but it does mean that there's something in my writing body clock which says, if I could get something finished by, you know, in the next 3 or 4 months, at least as a kind of draft so I can see where I am, then that would make me happy. And I'm all in favor of making myself happy. So that's what I'll probably aim at.
And what point would you start sharing it with someone? When do you have an editor involved or a first reader?
Only when I'm pretty happy with it myself, but then I can completely change it after that as well. Or if I'm not happy with it, but I just can't see where else I'm going, I wouldn't send a early chapters before I finish the whole thing. I definitely finish the whole thing. I definitely have what I consider to be a readable draft, even if it's not perfect. I don't think it's great. I'm not looking for affirmation, but I have to think, yeah, this is readable. You can see what I'm doing. And even when I give it to a first reader, I want the first reader to think, God, that this is good, you know. So at that stage, it can be quite far down the line. But then I take what those first readers say really quite seriously and find it very helpful. And I'm able to change a lot after that. I mean, I think the editing process is really tough because you come back to it and you're destroying a former iteration of yourself. So each time you change a line, you're destroying the self, the earlier self, which wrote that line and said that line is really good. And you're going back to your former self and saying you're not as good as you think you are. In fact, in some instances, you're really not very good at this writing business at all. And that takes a kind of an emotional courage, if you like, to actually go back to yourself and destroy yourself and remake the text. But I can do that because I find it quite easy to slip into the idea of, no, my next iteration is going to be better than the last one. It's optimistic, really. It's an optimism I think you need to bring to editing. So yeah, it's good. It actually feels good to make things better. And that's why I like that stage, because I like this, the idea that tomorrow, if I work all day today, my text will be better than it is now. And I find that very motivating.
Yeah, it's not at a cost to you that you're going back and saying that wasn't as good as it can be.
Yeah, because that form itself can feel a little bit of pain, but not, you know, nothing fatal.
And do you have established first readers? Are you got people that you always go to now?
I always send it to my brother, my older brother, who's a very, very harsh reader. If he likes it mostly, that's a pretty good sign. Because if he doesn't, he'll tell me.
Well, yeah, siblings really not going to like hold back. They're going to be the most honest.
But I know that because he is harsh, I do take that into account as well. Is it's, you know, I'm really looking for the bits that he likes. You know, otherwise, I think it's difficult with first readers before you get to the kind of professional stage. And obviously, when you get to the professional stage, you don't really have much choice but to make the changes which are suggested, because they are coming from the perspective of goodwill and wanting the book to do as well as possible. And it would be foolish really to ignore that. In my case, I'm very lucky in my editor in particular, who is Stuart Williams at Havelsecker. And he is an incredibly good reader. And if he questions something, then I'm 100% confident that it needs questioning. And I think that kind of relationship that you build up over the years, he did first book with me in 2003, is I'd had other editors before, but I started working with him in 2003. If you can build up that kind of relationship of trust and confidence, it's a huge help.
Obviously, that relationship's been going for nearly 20 years. Has over time, from your earliest books, has the time at which you feel confident to work away at it before you share it with the editor changed? With your first or second book, for example, was it expected that you would be sharing the produce earlier on?
The first book was bought when there were only 6 chapters out of 20. Mm. So that was a slightly different process. But then I was sort of left to go off and finished it and tried to get it into a state which I thought was perfect. And being very young, I was very foolish and was probably less accepting of change then and of advice than I've become since. And I've heard editors and agents say that since, is that it's hardest to work with writers on their first and second books because this kind of idea of collaboration hasn't yet been absorbed, I think. And that was certainly true for me. I mean, I felt every change like the first of a death by a thousand cuts. I just couldn't, I really wanted to believe I knew best because I'd sold my book. And it took a while to let other people join in with a collaborative creative process. And I enjoy that as much as anything now. That actually, again, it's the same idea of making it better.
Thank you to Richard for joining us, and thank you to you for listening.
Do remember to like, subscribe, etc., wherever you find this podcast. You can find us online at unsignedmethods.co.uk or on Twitter at unsignedmethods.
You can find out more about Richard and his writing in the episode notes below this episode, or you can find out about my writing at Jamie Batchen on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchen on Instagram, and jamiebatchen.com is my website.
And you can find me at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter, I'm Lachlan Bloom. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.